Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Ever since I was a small child, I have always been fascinated by the concept of a black hole. When I was in middle school, one of my first class presentations was on black holes. Then in high school, I wrote a report on black holes for my physics class. It wasn't until after college that I could actually learn what a black hole was, and the scientific concept goes back to Einstein. It was now over a century ago, in 1915, that Einstein first published his general theory of relativity. Among many other things, this theory predicted that a sufficiently compact body should not emit any light because gravity would prevent light from escaping the surface. The fact that light cannot propagate outward for such bodies has profound consequences. Since nothing could transmit any information outwards, there would be no way to keep anything supported against gravity, and when that happens, the whole system should collapse into a singularity. But this idea took a long time before it was accepted as a real phenomenon that existed out in the universe and not just some academic piece of mathematics. Nowadays, we accept that black holes exist, but because we have detected them in many different ways. In 2014, we first detected the gravitational waves from two black holes merging. That is, these two black holes, as they spiraled in towards each other, stretched and contorted the space-time around them, sending ripples in the fabric of space-time outward, which we now are able to detect with very sensitive technology on Earth. And the precise shape of the wave that we detected was exactly what theorists predicted it would look like based on Einstein's equations of general relativity. Even more convincing evidence was presented a few years ago when the Event Horizon Telescope actually imaged the black hole at the center of the nearby galaxy M87. You may remember this picture of a black hole as sort of a blurry donut. You of course can't see the black hole itself, but you see the gas falling into the black hole, which exhibits a dark cavity at the center where the black hole is. The black hole at the center of M87 is what we call a supermassive black hole. Its mass is nearly 10 billion times the mass of our Sun. You might wonder how a black hole can possibly get to be that big, and many scientists also wonder the same thing. But recently, there's been an interesting idea floating around the astrophysics community. You know that ring of gas around M87? That ring of gas itself is absolutely massive, and it might be a place where many stars get captured and spend their whole lives there, eventually forming compact objects like neutron stars and black holes. You can almost think of it like a giant super solar system with the supermassive black hole at the center and thousands of stars and black holes orbiting around it like planets. It's an incredible thought, and it might help to explain some of the more massive black hole merger events that have been detected since 2014. It takes a very bright mind to try to calculate how these giant black hole solar systems should behave, and whether there's any way we can test for them. My guest today is Dr. Rosalba Perna from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Stony Brook University. Dr. Perna is a theoretical astrophysicist who spends her time thinking a little bit about everything, and in particular these days she has thought a lot about how a supermassive black hole like the one in M87 might support a whole system of stars, black holes, and neutron stars orbiting around it in a gaseous disk. We're going to talk with Rosalba about what it takes to become a theoretical astrophysicist and what kind of crazy things might be going on out there in the universe. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. I might be interrupting you a lot because
it's a conversation.
Exactly. All right. Exactly. Good. Just to make sure I'm
Italian, so
I'm, of course you'll be interrupting me way more.
Right, exactly.
That's right. Good.
It's our inner nature.
All right. Good. Well, as long as that's settled. All right. And you ready to get started?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll do my intro. All right. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Rosalba Perna, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Stony Brook University. Dr. Perna, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting.
So we first met when I was a graduate student at NYU, and we even worked on a paper together way back then. I don't know if you, like...
I do remember. It was okay. A lot of fun, actually, working with you.
Excellent. So I guess I want to start talking about you personally and how you grew up to be a scientist before we get into the science. So first, let me start with, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a small little town in the middle of nowhere in the south of Italy.
Really?
So even if I tell you the name, you probably won't know of it. But the general area is one near Salerno, which you may or may not know, which is closer to Naples and Pompeii, which I'm sure you have heard of.
So kind of vaguely near Naples and Pompeii.
Exactly. But in the inner part, so it was like a tiny little town.
Okay. So what was it like growing up in a tiny little town in Italy?
Well, there was not much to do in terms of like external activities, so you had to make up your own activities.
Okay.
Like, for example, I like to play, I don't know, at some point I got into volleyball, but there was no net, you know, no public place. So the gate of my father's, you know, my parents' house became, you know, the gate, they became the net for play. So a lot of, it was actually, I think, it forced to be more creative, because when you didn't have, you know, raw material to play, you kind of had to make your own things.
Okay, that really paints a picture. I wanted to play volleyball, but we didn't have a net in our town. No.
So the gate to the house.
Was
a bird. That's an example. So a lot of, I had a very good time with just, you know, making up a lot of stuff with my friends.
That's nice. It's funny, I'm now getting, this is starting to be a theme, like, with various guests that they say, like, I've had now several of them say they grew up in a small, so Yuan Li grew up in a small city of 3 million people, so that doesn't count, but in China, that's very small.
Mine is 6,000 people, so that's the reference.
Okay. Anyway, and do you have a memory of the first time you, like, got interested in science or astronomy?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting question, because a lot of people ask, you know, when you got interested, also because I was not exposed to it. My parents were elementary school teachers, and, you know, there was no particular, you know, science interest on either part.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody remembers when I took an exam, because I'd skipped the first year of school for some reasons, and then the teacher, who the person was going to be my teacher, was doing this exam, asked, "Would you want to do when you grow up?" And I said that I wanted to be a scientist that studied the atoms and the universe. This question.
That was your answer.
That was my
out of nowhere.
So somehow, I don't know, probably things on TV. I have literally no memory of the moment that I said, okay, what I do in my life, I want to be an astrophysicist.
Right.
Because it's like, I always knew, like, I grew up with it.
As long as you can remember back.
As long as I can remember. So I feel like, I feel like I'm very lucky, because it's like, it's always, I make money, so to speak, with the things that has always been my passion since I remember. So there's no moment of decision. I sort of, you know, I always knew that was what I wanted to do.
That's cool.
So I feel very lucky in having that.
And you said your parents were elementary school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, how, you know, in what did they influence you at all? And, like, how, I don't know, like, they were obviously interested in education. Mm-hmm. But
So there was a strong interest in education, you know, in terms, I mean, they wanted, you know, me and my sister, I have a sister, you know, doing well in school, but it was never pressure to, like, you know, like, you have to succeed, or, like, you know, they cared that we studied it.
Right.
And, my father, what he really cared was that we studied music. So there was actually, if there was one thing they were really pushing.
So was he... like a music teacher?
No, it was elementary, so you'd have no specialization.
Okay.
So my parents had no college degree, because at the time there was no. So
why music? Why was
he? Because he always had a passion for music, but it came from a family that was way too poor to consider anything, any study.
And this was his, like, dream that you could just study music and.
Exactly. Yeah. And also there was a bit of, I had to say, growing up in, you know, like, in the south of Italy many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents were a bit conservative in the sense of, like, as women, you know, me and my sister, we were, you know, only two, you sort of need to find a job that is secure, because my father, you know, he lived the war, so they didn't have, you know, enough to eat. So that's how he grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, the idea that securing a job. And in music, because I mean, there's teachers in school, you know, which is like any other teacher. Mm-hmm. But then, like with private classes, basically, you know, they're really sought after, mm-hmm. and they're very mobile. So the idea is like, okay, then you can follow your husbands wherever they are. You can teach music.
Oh, I see.
So it was a combination of something that he liked, and in fact, he started to, you know, like learn on his own after, you know, when me and my sister started to study music. But at the same time, it was also this idea that you have a secure way
of that if you're a woman, you could study music and then therefore you could get a husband and just do the music while he did the real job.
So it was a bit of that. So yeah, and again, you know, my parents were, you know, great people, but you know, that was like in, you know, in the mindset of, so I grew up a bit with that, which didn't go with physics very
still,
much.
But then did it influence you to like?
So basically then, well, both me and my sister, even though music was not our passion, so I'm a pianist.
Okay.
So I studied, like there was, you know, there was like the one thing where there was no discussion, like, you know, my father was like, you can do whatever you want on, you know, in your, I wanted to do physics, so obviously that was forever. He tried to convince me towards biology because it's like, okay, if it has to be science, since it was clearly a science thing, he's like, okay, biology, maybe it's more a woman appropriate, but
like,
the
no.
fight, but that didn't go.
No.
But then it was like, I had to do, you know, music. So basically I ended up with a music degree just, you know,
to satisfy,
which is, I mean, which is fine, but you know, it was obvious a lot of time on the side to do it in parallel, but.
But it's nice. It's not like he forbade you from learning about astrophysics.
But
it was a lot of strong encouragement.
There was a lot of strong encouragement to do biology instead of physics. So
That's interesting. And so, and that was from mostly your dad, but was your mom?
My mother, no, she was very, my mother, yeah, it was, my father had a very strong personality. My mm-hmm. mother, not, mm-hmm. You know, as long, she didn't, she was going along with whatever my mm-hmm. father, mm-hmm. so I didn't remember her,
like,
you know,
pushing in particular.
Pushing either, either way.
But it's, you know, in the end, it was overall good for you. Like, you managed to have a pretty well-rounded, like, you ended up, like, learning piano, and, like, that's pretty good. And I didn't learn piano, so. But that's, so then, what do you think drove you, like, towards astrophysics specifically? Or as you were saying, it's always been...
I think it's like, because also, actually, again, so memories that I have, because it's, you know, in this small little town, you know, like, even, like, books and things that weren't arriving with regularity. And I remember once, in one of the, you know, local library, they were bringing, like, there was this encyclopedia that they that's being... you know, it was coming in little episodes, so like it was something like, and it was like, you know, low level, like, you know, just divulgative. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the advertisement for it, and then they told me, no, you have to order specially for you. But for me, it was like, oh, of course. So it was like, I was waiting like the Wednesday. I remember.
So this would be like in a subscription like almost like we have Sky and Telescope or whatever.
Exactly, it would be one of, exactly. It was arriving, like, you know, that you build it over time.
Yes.
But they were only, you know, bringing the number that of people interested. So basically, I remember, like, I was so fascinated. And so there was like, maybe I could have been probably end of elementary school. So there was, so I remember the best day of the week was when I was getting the new. So I don't know.
That's cool.
It's interesting because again, it was. I don't know where it came from. Probably.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's just you get something in the mail when it's a kid and you're excited.
Yeah, or like maybe TV. Because we had this, you know, like a Carl Sagan type of things.
Yeah,
like there was like Italy had its own equivalent.
Oh, okay.
And I suspect because again, I have no memory to say, oh, this is the first time I heard it, but I remember that. You know, whenever there were these episodes, like, everybody has to be quiet. I wanted to, you know, there was, like, no discussion.
I got to concentrate.
So my parents were, you know, a little mystified.
That's
how,
funny.
You know.
So who's the Italian Carl Sagan?
His name,
that's
gosh,
okay.
Now it's like,
that's all right.
There we go.
I was
he will
just
come
curious.
Back. Yeah.
It's not going to be relevant to anything. I just was curious.
But I have to remember because it was Quark. It was actually, I remember the title of the.
Oh, it was called Quark.
It was called, the title of the.
The title of the show.
The show, yeah.
Okay, that's cool. Well, I want to watch that, except I won't understand anything. I'll need subtitles. But I kind of asked this, but why, you know, you said, like, you didn't, you know, you were clearly wanted to do astrophysics and not biology. So why do you think astrophysics?
It's still, yeah, because it's actually, it's an interesting question, because sometimes I feel like I still, you know, like, well, I'm fascinated by the areas of physics, like, you know, like anything involving quantum mechanics and extreme physics. It's but I still feel like the universe, it's for me, is the most fascinating, you know, realm for studying physics. So in the end, you know, astrophysics, you know, it's just one area where we apply the laws of physics.
So generally you might have been happy doing physics on something else, but astrophysics is the most sort of.
I think, and as a matter of fact, because I studied physics in Italy, but also it was like in the town Salerno, which was, as I did the undergrad there, there was no astro. So there I did my thesis, actually was in condensed matter. So I also, you know, I quite enjoy doing condensed matter. Okay. But when I moved then for my PhD, and then I thought, okay, what, you know, it was natural, like, okay, I want to apply physics, but it's just so much more fascinating. Like, I feel like, you know, things like compact objects, and they are, you know, cooler than materials.
Than the materials that you can just make on Earth. I was realizing, like, you probably had a really awesome view of the night sky from where you were, because you were in this small town.
It was a small town, but it's also because that's the other thing. Also, I've always been more, I think, theoretically oriented. Like, I was, you know, looking at the sky, but it wasn't like I was never searching, you know, for a, like, I never asked my father to buy me a telescope, which is also kind of interesting. But I was always fascinated, you know, for example, black holes, the first time I came across concept. So it was more the intrigue.
It was more in your mind.
It was more in my mind. Yeah. Like
these concepts of, like, a black hole.
Yeah. Like, first time I read about it, you know, theory of special relativity, general relativity, you know, in a divulgative way, I was so fascinated by it. So it wasn't looking at the sky. It's the way many people started.
Right, because a lot of people just aesthetically, they like it, how it looks, but you're like, no, I like the ideas.
But for me, it was like, this, you know, all that's out there, you know, how infinite, you know, like how big the universe is. Yes. So for me, it was like mind-boggling.
When do you feel like you learned how to be a scientist?
It's a good question. So I was lucky that I had very good teachers. Well, it was not as much as physics, so it was not, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of physics, even though I was doing the scientific high school. I mean, it depends a lot on your teacher. Mm-hmm. But, like, very good math teachers. Mm-hmm. And what I felt like I started to learn with them and appreciate it a lot, because, like, you know, three in a row had some, especially two of them, two out of three. One was, like, super strict and, you know, very formal.
Okay.
But two of them had a common element, which was, like, sort of they give you a problem, and then you can think about it, or, like, doing a very long, but then if you think out of the box, you can solve that problem with two lines.
Oh, right.
And for me, that was, like, something really special in the way I appreciate, like, I really like it.
It's a little reward that you can do the problem quicker if you can think of a clever way of doing it.
Right, like this thinking out of the box, I felt like.
That's actually, there's definitely a name for this, but it's in when people, video game designers have the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Where they'll make two ways you can do it. You can do this long.
Okay, convoluted and more standard.
Out a clever way of getting through it.
Interesting.
And a lot of video game design, they like have that concept in it because they like anyway. But there is a name for that concept where you get a like little reward by doing it,
Right. So that's something I learned to appreciate, and I was like really enjoying the, you know, like when I could find. So I don't know if that, you know, answer exactly the question how to be a scientist, but it's like it was for me something that I was really liking as. Like think, you know, the sort of thinking out of the box, because you could always solve the problem, you know, following the standard proceeding, you know, very long and tedious, where you know the steps, or you think out of the box and then you solve the problem in another path. And I felt like for me, that was like always very attractive.
Yes, you feel, that is very cool. Now I'm thinking about it, I should like think about that while I'm designing the courses I teach. I'm like, I didn't put any thought into that. I should probably do that. But it's interesting. So you go back all the way to like high school when you're thinking about like becoming.
That was high school, yeah. Right? And then, I had a very good university, even though, it was a small place mm-hmm. in the south of Italy, but it was like really hardcore. Okay. So it was like, I learned, very formal work. And then while doing research came, mm-hmm. With the PhD, I guess, in the more normal path.
So where did you go to grad school?
So it's Harvard.
Okay. Oh, right. That's right. You did your PhD at Harvard.
Physics department, right? Because I was in physics,
But you did astrophysics,
and
but
then
you were
I
just
did
in
thesis,
the...
right, in astro. Because I also, I had no idea how the old U.S. system came because I was like in this, small town, like nobody knew anybody.
We don't know either. It's like fine.
I wanted to. Well, it's there are two things. Like for one, I always thought of myself as a physicist who then applies physics to astro. So I never thought, even though I had that in mind, I never thought of. Applied to an astronomy part. It was at Harvard that physics and astronomy.
Right.
But also then I didn't, because I had done condensed matter, I thought maybe it would be more natural to apply to physics and then,
from their point of view, I didn't know. I had exactly the same thought process when I applied. I applied to physics programs, and that's NYU physics program. It's weird, different universities, we're the Department of Physics and Astronomy, but some will have it separated. Yeah, so it's not clear which one you're supposed to apply to.
Exactly. So Harvard is separated, but for me, I think it was clear because on one side I wanted to do astro, on the other I felt like I still wanted to do physics as for coursework and
because that's the thing is those are the problems you like doing, and that's as a theorist.
That's right. Exactly.
That's right. Do you think about it in terms of the problems you want to do?
Yeah, and then the context you're learning from the astronomer. So the first time I remember talking about the person who became my advisor, and I had zero astronomy knowledge, and mm-hmm. I remember he was proposing project when I was just going, going around asking. I remember, mm-hmm. There are this galaxy redshift 3, and I remember he was very excited, and I was like, what does that mean?
What's redshift 3 mean?
Three with this, it seems like small number, I don't know, but he's so excited, so I was very puzzled by his excitement for something with a number of 3 in the universe. So that shows how the contest came later.
Right. Yeah, and I feel like I had the same thing. I didn't have any of the astro training, and I just kind of for a while, I was kind of just going along with things people said to me. I was like, yes. That sounds right.
And then how much basic astronomy I've actually taught teaching 101, mm-hmm. this basic introduction, all the, many things.
Well, that's where you really learn astronomy, is when you have to teach it to people suddenly.
Exactly.
That's cool. So then, so that was you did your PhD at Harvard, and then you did, what did you
then
after
I
that?
Then I was a junior fellow at Harvard, so I stayed.
Oh, you stayed at Harvard.
I stayed at Harvard.
They held on to you. They didn't let go. So now you're an astrophysicist. What are some things that you like the most about your job?
So I like the freedom to think about what I, to just go along with whatever attracts me. It's a very creative job, and I think that's basically the fact that, you don't have, specific task. I mean, you have, there's the admission, the administrative part, there is the teaching.
Yes.
Which is also good and fun in some other ways. But I really the fact that the research is still something that excites me as much as at the beginning. There is a new observation you hear, and you, as a theorist, you can just,
Let me just go on this tangent.
Exactly.
No one's telling me that I can't do this.
So it's an incredible luxury, I feel, especially because as I said, it was always my passion. So I still like having it as a job. So that's
it is very cool, but it has this sort of like, I think for some people that's scary, right? Because you just have to come up.
Absolutely.
You're just sitting there in a room. Yeah. I have to come up with something.
Yeah, and it is actually there is a scary. Yeah. Like when I started as a, and in fact, like, you know, I've always been like, you know, not very confident, so to speak. So, you know, I remember when I started with the faculty, I was like, oh my God, and now I have not only have to have ideas for myself, but there are students to whom I have to give, you know, because for me, okay, I don't have ideas for a while, then it's like, okay, whatever. But now, like, actually, a student starts with me, and I need, so
and
there was like,
dependent on you, and they depend on me. A good enough idea, they'll get a PhD, and they'll be able to get a good job from that. And
Yeah. So there is like, there is this pressure, so it's exactly what you're saying. So I do feel that, because it's like, but you know, I think everything comes with a reward, wherever there's a stress.
I feel like you never have any shortage of like interesting ideas, but I guess the question is when you have like, when is it appropriate for the student to, you know, like
to do. And then it's like, so I mean, it's actually the last 10 years to say with two students at Stony Brook, I've been super lucky because they were both like, and actually my since you've been a Boulder, I guess I can just say that my first graduate student from Stony Brook, Teodoro, just accepted faculty position in Boulder. So it's funny, you know, talking about
That must be, oh my God, that's so cool. I mean, that must be so rewarding when you have a grad student that's now in faculty.
And he was hired by my former institution.
And he was hired, just like basically kind of got your old job when you were a faculty at Boulder.
It's kind of funny.
That's cool, though.
But yeah, generally, I mean, I'm sure you find the same, like, you know, with any student, you try to find the best match with their interest and and then, you know, like, you know, both students and, you know, the other, you know, the also the second one I had were incredibly talented numerically, as you were yourself, you are yourself, Paul. And that actually has been like, you know, I felt like it was a match made in heaven for me as an advisor.
Oh, yes. Because you just have a student like, who can do the coding.
Like,
any,
like in you know, in a lot of different areas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like if I have an idea of, you know, in some area, then I can, you know, immediately, you know, talk. And, so it doesn't have to be, you know, because, you know, with most students, you know, most people, you have a project and, you know, you do continuation. It's sort of like within a certain area. Mm-hmm. But then when you have students that are, you know, very talented and can move around, you know, different areas, then it's great because it's like we work together very well, and if at some, you know, at some moment I feel like, oh, there's this thing interesting, what do you think? And like, okay, let's work on this other thing.
And then you're right, it is especially specifically computational astrophysics. When you just get it good at computational astrophysics and you just jump to like, I'm going to do a computation of that thing.
Yeah, exactly,
and,
exactly.
And I've never worked on before.
Exactly. So it's been a lot of
That's good. Okay, I asked you what you like about your job. Now, is there anything you don't like about your job?
It's, I mean, there are times when, you know, I mean, like, I think, you know, departments are like, I think any, you know, it's like big families. And like, you know, sometimes there are, you know, anything that has to do more with politics and something, it's, I feel like it's very not natural for me.
And that's probably actually even more so for you, because you are a department.
So I've been associate chair for the last 3 years, right? The first time, so that's like,
yeah, that's probably not.
Yeah, where you're being brought in. Yeah, like there's a lot of other things that you know, you unavoidably have to deal with. And I realize I find those extremely stressful for me, because I like, well, always, you know, everybody to be happy, and I'm very conflict averse in general, but you know, sometimes you see conflict among, you know, people or things that are, you know, not exactly in the way I would want them to be.
And you have to step you're expected to be the one to fix,
yeah,
fix
so
everything.
So that's a part I don't, and in fact, you know, I will not, after this, I already said I would step down, because I feel like it was good, because there were certain things that were important to me, and actually they happened,
but dealing with that day after day.
I'm back you know, to, because I had, you know, somewhat reduced teaching due to that, but I'm happy to go to, you know, my full teaching and then step down now from from
our administration. Nice. So then you'll be able to focus more on your research, and, and that's good. Okay, well, that was, I mean, I don't look forward to dealing with anything like that. Well, I'll just do a bad enough job, they will never make me chair of anything. But
I'm sure you'll it would be very hard, but you'll have to work really hard at making a bad job and knowing you, Paul.
So, okay, what would you say was the most challenging part of getting to where you are in academia?
It's interesting. I think it was a combination. I did, you know, I'm from the older generation where I feel like there was, I did go through like some, you know, unconscious bias, unconscious or conscious. Maybe, you know, my former institution in Colorado was like, at the time I was there, it was still, you know, it was, I think now, I mean, it's a very different environment, but at the time, it was a bit of, you know, old boy club.
Okay, yes.
And that was the, it's been, you know, living in that environment has been difficult, because like, I felt like, as a woman, also shy, you know, not very, like, you know, like I'm not very argumentative, you know, sort of like very loud, I mean, and whatever. I had to work harder to be, you know, like, recognize this.
I always think about that, especially now, like when I'm in a position where like my decisions will affect things like this, but like, you know, so many different personalities are good at this, but the ones that like really, then they'll have the really strong personalities that go like, we're the ones.
Strong person. It's like, which I don't, like I'm very, you know, like, I mean, I've changed a lot, like becoming, at least I speak a little bit more now, but you know, I was generally, I mean, you knew me for a long time and you know, I tend to be more quiet and more, you know, like, so it's very easy for, you know, like take sort of quote take advantage of the people that are, you know, very quiet, you think they will never complain of anything, and then it just, you know, it falls into a pattern
And we want to encourage like people that are not quite as like, you know, you're Italian, I definitely like try to look out, be on the lookout for that when there's students who are maybe not as you know, encourage them to speak up, but also kind of also encourage people to like listen to them, right? Because it's not just about them needing to become like everybody else. It's about everybody kind of there's different personalities, and we have to be able to you know, interact with each other.
And it's something you see in a big group, but there is always, you know, often, like, I mean, we see in classrooms as well, there is always, you know, it's a group of people that will talk all the time, and others that don't speak, but it's not because, you know, then you see the exams, and not that, you know, there's a few that are, you know, as good or better, but it's just they're, you know, they're more quiet. They don't have this personality of always, like, you know, being the one.
But you're right. It's the people that really, the people that mostly do very well are the people that are, like, very engaged and jumping in and like, hey, how you doing? This is my name.
Exactly. And I was actually, so it was a combination of, you know, being like that, and then, like, I think that, like, it became a bit of a domino effect, because I was also, you know, the fewer talks I would, like, I was also, I was turning down talks invitation for a beginning, so I was also, so it was not only, like, I wasn't, you know, like pushing
so
myself.
So people were offering, you come here, give a talk. And we want to hear about your research. And you're like, I
declined.
Don't
So during my postdoc, it was terrible. It's, but yeah, so I think there was also part that I was really shy. Like, it's in a, so yeah, and so it doesn't help having, you know, being in a culture which is already promoting, you know, more the people, you know, the loud, then people push themselves. And then, you know, in my case, I even, so it was a double one. But it's, you know, I've learned from myself, but mostly I'm trying to encourage now, you know, students that I see, they're very shy. They feel like, okay, I will never make it or whatever. You know, just I start from small steps and, you know, eventually, you know, also, at least like I feel like, you know, there is a people also look, you know, really at your work and you know, mm-hmm. and then, you know, go to conference. Maybe you won't be the one who go and meet everyone and mm-hmm. introduce themselves, but if you give a very good talk, then, you know, people will come and talk mm-hmm. to you and
yeah.
So I try to push, because, you know, also, you know, like my students, you know, the last two students, I mean, these very good students I've had, they're both, you know, similar personality to me, that they're not like super pushing, and I feel like maybe that's why we got along very well, because it's like, but then I'm trying to really encourage them not to do what, you know, what I did, that was like, so just, you know, go to conference and prepare like a super good talk, mm-hmm. because then that's how people, you know, they get an impression, and
yes,
and then, you know, they then it's easier, the conversation after, you don't have to, you know, go and introduce.
It won't be the same immediate impact of like
someone come to
giving
everyone,
like you don't have business cards anymore,
but
giving
that is like, I mean, I see people doing that, and like the equivalent
of,
make
sure you shake everybody's hand.
Exactly. It's like, look at my, you know, look at my talk, look at my poster.
It can be a big long-term benefit if you do things that way too. Yeah. Like, if, because some, you know, sometimes it can rub people the wrong way if you're too pushy.
Right. Yeah. And for me, maybe because I, you know, I'm kind of the opposite. It doesn't necessarily like, because I can read through, like, see, like, you know, this aspect of being too, it's not necessarily, you know, the one that I will appreciate it the most as a quality. Almost feel like, okay, sometimes you need to compensate for, you know, for other things.
So let's shift gears and talk. I know you're like looking at your watch. Was I not supposed to announce that you're looking at your watch? Anyway, we'll shift gears and talk about science. So when you meet a new grad student or a fellow scientist and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
So it's a question that varies in time.
Okay.
Because I as you probably know, like, I tend to work on a lot of different topics. Mm-hmm. So and that's, you know, part of why I like the job as a theorist, that it's, you know, like something, there is something new that I hear and then I start working on it. Mm-hmm. So you know, in the last, for example, few years, I started to work some on aging discs, which is will be the topic of today. But up to 3 years ago, I basically, you know, aging discs weren't even in my radar as something on.
So the short answer is you work on a little bit of everything in astrophysics.
But I like to work, you know, like a different topics, and mostly motivated by, because mostly by what interests me, but also like there is often no planning about what I, you know, because sometimes students ask you, what, you know, what's your research in the next, you know, 3 years, and I, you know, my most honest answer is that I mean, I can tell you maybe 30% of it, but the other 70% is like, you know, for example, like.
But is, I mean, let's give a flavor of like the type, like, I mean, okay, like, so AGN disks is one example, one current example, but like, what are some other things?
For another current example, for example, I don't know if you followed her, so in the fall, it was all over the news that James Webb Telescope had discovered binary planets. Floating binary planets.
Free
floating binary planets. They were named Jumbo.
Okay.
And
I didn't know about this.
So
I should probably pay attention to this stuff.
Well, the funny thing is that I'd missed the paper from the archive, because it appeared on, but I saw it as I was reading BBC News, so that was
okay. And get it somehow.
The funny thing, it was and that got my attention. I was like, that's, you know, because it's like a fun new discovery. How can they be produced? And then, well, I had an idea for a possibility, and then I talked to my former students, now postdoc, about it. He had already, because I'd already worked in an area of planetary architectures in the interactive environment. So you had already, you know, the code pretty much set up. So, you know, so we worked on this idea that, you know, was promising, and the paper is actually accepted.
But I'm trying to think of what the common link is between the various.
There's no link.
You just, anything you're interested in, you just go, I'm going to try to do that.
It's like, it's sometimes like some papers start with, I don't know, like someone giving a talk, and it triggers something in my mind and links maybe to something else that I've heard, and then I go and talk to the speaker after, because I'm shy to ask questions during the talk, as I will do. And then some works have started exactly like that. But then even within those, there's like many, you know, branches that are, you know, some are more cosmologic application, other more, you know, physics of accretion, so completely uncorrelated.
So I'm just not going to get an answer for this question.
Because I don't think there is an answer. It's an interesting question, because it's like, if I think, is there a common path? And I think a common path is just like when I hear something, some phenomena that, you know, observation there unexplained, I'm just naturally keen to think about it, you know. So it's, and, you know, they can be in any, you know, it can be in anything. So it's
okay.
And then like.
But how do you do? Okay, so that's a little bit crazy, because how do you, like? I mean, for me, I have, you know, expertise in computational fluid dynamics, and so I definitely work on a wide range of topics. Mm. But there's usually a link that there's a gas fluid involved somewhere, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think for me the link is more generally, I don't know. Maybe the it's maybe, you know, just physics.
Okay,
I don't know.
It's physics.
Maybe
if there's physics, if there's a decent amount of physics in there.
It's maybe because already with my, during my PhD, I was already maybe started from there. Like, like I started in gravitational lensing, so a cosmology and dust. Then I had the paper on the warm, hot intergalactic medium in absorption with the oxygen line. So there was the, you know, like a cosmology intergalactic medium. And then it was gamma ray burst, which is probably how you know me, because I wrote the thesis.
Right.
Only on gamma ray burst. So it's already from there, but it was like, it was always very easy to switch from one to the other. It's, and again, I feel like with the, you know, physics background, it's, you know, then it's just the context.
I mean, you're right. That's the whole, I guess, kind of the whole idea and conceit of physics, that once you know physics,
it's also, you know, a lot of the things now, you know, it's more like, you know, maybe I may conceive the idea, but then, embodied dynamics, for example, I have never, you know, coded like anything embodied, but I have a lot of papers on embodied because I've, you know, worked with my former student. It was like a fantastic, you know, computational scientist.
Okay, so then, so the answer to that is you work on everything.
No. I work on a number of different,
Any given time, there's any topic in astrophysics you might work on if there's an interesting problem.
If it crosses my path, and I have some insight into it, which is, again, it happens on and off.
An example? Now, what you're working on is what you could say AGN disks, which we should explain what that is. So AGN stands for active galactic nuclei. And what that really, I guess, means is why don't you explain what that means?
So these are very bright sources that we see in the sky, and they're powered, so supermassive black hole in the center, and then so that's the central source, and then there is a gas accreting onto the supermassive black hole, which results in a lot of energy, and these sources are known, you know, also as quasars, as one subset, but in astro we call them more AGN.
So active galactic, so the nucleus part is like there's a supermassive black hole basically at the center of
every galaxy.
Supermassive, we mean like a million times the mass of the sun, or a billion times the mass of the sun.
It's basically anything in between. So 10 to the 6, it probably is like the smaller ones are
a million times the mass of the sun, and then it goes up to
a billion,
there's some even more. So then, and those really, really giant black holes are accreting gas from the galaxy that are...
Right, from accretion disks that are there for a period of time. So there may be cycles in the lifetime of every galaxy during which...
So, every once in a while there'll be some gas that is in present and forms a disk around it. And then the accretion process where that gas falls onto it powers that releases a lot of energy.
A lot of energy, right, exactly.
It's counterintuitively, like, these black holes are some of the brightest objects we can look at because of how much energy is released there.
Indeed. And the aspect that, so AGNs have been well studied and known for many years, but the aspect that has caught a bit of my attention in recent times is the presence of combat objects. Here we go back.
So, okay.
See, Paul, there is a theme sometimes.
Yes.
There is a connection about different things. So here, the connection is that the presence of combat objects within AGN disks, which is something I never thought of, but in...
So when you say compact objects, do you basically mean black holes, or do you mean neutron stars?
So it's both. So both the neutron stars. So black holes, which is small, but this would be now small black holes. So the ones that are resulting from the explosion of massive stars. So there will be, unlike the supermassive black holes, which are in the center, you know, million to billions of solar masses, this will be black holes. So like 10, you know, let's say 10, between 10, 20. So that's a typical number of solar masses. So they're still big, but they're much smaller.
Okay, so I'm picturing you have a very large, like million to a billion times the mass of the sun black hole. It's very large, there's a big gaseous disk, and inside that gaseous disk there's a whole bunch of more like regular size, like around the mass of the sun, well, 10 times the mass of the sun, 20 times the mass of some black holes that are in this disk. And so it's not just the one giant, and there's a whole bunch of also little black holes that we imagine might be in this disk.
We imagine maybe, exactly. Right. So, yeah, exactly.
And understanding how they
evolve, and what are the properties. So it's not only black holes, but also neutron stars. And they can migrate within the disk, as you know a lot about that. They can form binary
black hole system themselves.
Right. So basically, a binary, you know, would be a system in which the two objects are bound together by gravity, so they move together, and then over time they lose gravitational waves, which has been, you know, one of the exciting new discoveries in the last few years, and eventually merge. And when they merge, there will be a big burst of gravitational waves. But being in an AGN disk, it has been suggested that may also be a counterpart in electromagnetic radiation, which would not be seen. It would be very unlikely. It would have to require very special environments in black holes, in the standard galactic environments.
Okay. So the idea is we've seen from the LIGO Observatory, we've seen gravitational waves from merging black holes, you know, in that range, 10 to 20, 30 solar times the mass of the sun, and they merge and they produce this gravitational radiation, which is basically stretching space-time and producing these waves that we can actually detect now. As you said, it's this great discovery that we found recently. But then you said it's possible that maybe some of these events are happening if you picture that, you know, maybe there's, you know, you can ask whether there's any gas around it. Maybe if there were just black holes out in the universe, there wouldn't be much gas around them. Mm-hmm. But if those black holes also were formed in an AGN disk, then there would be lots of gas around.
Exactly.
And then that gas could then maybe release a whole bunch of energy, and we may be able to see something else other than just the gravitational waves.
Exactly. So that.
Okay.
Thank
just
you
trying
very
to re- summarize.
Yes, that's exactly. Right. You summarize it perfectly clearly. So those are ideas that we suggest. No, those are not my ideas. So those are ideas of, you know, other people that have suggested that this mergers, at least a fraction, you know, a sizable fraction of them may happen in AGN disks. And then from there, I guess it got me thinking about, other aspects connected to, you know, if there are black holes, to AGN disks. So if there are black holes, they came from somewhere, so maybe they were stars. Okay, if stars explode and form black holes, we know very well that our old friends gamma ray bursts may happen. If there are neutron stars and form binaries, that would be short GRBs. So from there I started to think about phenomena connected to compact objects in AGN disks.
So not just thinking about the actual merger event of two black holes, but what other things do we think of if we imagine these disks are filled with black holes and neutron stars?
Right, exactly.
What other things could they be doing?
Exactly.
That other than just thinking about black holes merging, you could think about things
other
that we
aspects, right?
As you mentioned, like gamma ray bursts and supernovae and the other things.
Exactly.
That we
other people, yeah. Suggest also like just thunder supernovae and also. You know, the fact that there is a high density objects, you know, accrete a lot. So also neutron star can accrete a lot, and white dwarfs can accrete a lot. And therefore, one can easily induce these objects to collapse because each of them can only sustain a maximum mass from physics and then collapse and produce some type of explosive phenomenon.
So if these neutron stars are in the disk, they presumably can only be there for so long before the gas keeps piling up on them and then they collapse to a black hole. Okay, so then let me ask, what is... You know, if you're okay, this is the general idea that you're interested in right now, or one of the ideas. Right? Sorry, I don't want to make it sound
It's what I'm thinking right now.
What would day-to-day research look like for something like that? You don't have to get too specific, but like what would your day? I don't know, trying to solve a problem like that, or even day-to-day for your students.
So, for example, projects. So one question which is actually a student is working on is trying to to estimate for long and short JRBs if they happen in Aegean disk how likely we are to see them, how many we would see.
I see.
And because they would, these gamma ray bursts are followed by longer wavelength radiation, which would have to emerge above the radiation of the Aegean disk.
I see. So these ideas, these other types of transient events like gamma ray bursts, you kind of figure out what the probability or how often that would happen.
So that's basically, for example, one student now is calculating, because up to now we have worked the more, okay, if you have, first of all, can a star in Aegean disk form a JRB with more or less, it's evolving normally in a way that would lead to a JRB or not, because we know that the property of stars had to be a bit special. So like, high rotation and things like that. So, earlier questions were, how likely is that to be in an Aegean disk? And we the answer to that question was that yes, it's very likely.
Okay.
So then another question.
So how do we know? Okay, this is going to be, maybe this answer is too technical.
Yeah, but
how do we know, like, how often any of these things are in these disks?
So that's basically the question now, because it's also very much related to this question, how, the fraction of black hole mergers that may contribute to the gravitational wave channel, which is something that people actually are super interested in.
Right.
But the two are connected, because if you have a certain number of compact objects, so people have estimated how many you would, you can expect in a disk. Other groups, previous work in that. But I feel like I want to connect it. So if there is a certain number, let's say normalization with some errors, and that will have to translate into a number of gamma ray bursts that we would have to see from this disk.
Okay. So if we see, if there's a certain fraction, there's a certain rate that like black holes are merging, that implies all these other things that should also be happening.
Exactly. So basically that's what we are. So that's the, one student now looking exactly at this aspect and basically trying to constrain, this normalization on the number of objects, which is, again, people have estimated, but it's subject to, as you can imagine, to a huge degree of uncertainty. But on the other hand, it connects to the observable associated with them.
So like at least there's certainly a hard limit there on how many gravitational waves we've seen merging black holes.
And there are ideas that they may even that AGN may be a contributing channel to a high degree. So there are groups that believe that the Aegean channel is actually, very well represented in the others do not. So, it all relates basically to how many black holes we have in this.
In other words, there's I guess we don't know really, but there's some folks that think that maybe most of these mergers happened in the Aegean disk. And then maybe other people don't think that, but at least that gives some range of rates that they could
be. Exactly. So yeah, so, you know, a student now, so, you know, it's going back to your question, the day-to-day research is, you know, it's like trying to estimate how many we would predict in terms of, you know, long and short GRBs coming from AGN disks. And that's something that's, you know, more, you know, easily observable in a way, because AGNs are observed in, you know, with transient surveys, and now there will be many more coming in. So the afterglow, you know, if there is a certain variability, a certain spike in the
luminosity. So there are surveys that'll specifically look at these bright
transients, right?
You're saying like that there are surveys that will actually look at AGN disks, these bright sources, and then see if there's anything else, any transients going on.
They will be looking at all.
They won't be specifically focusing on, but they will catch lots of these black holes.
So like the Rubin Observatory will be observing, looking for just transient sorties.
So if you want to go through the data, you can see, are we getting?
So then that's the idea. So basically going, you know, once we have collected data from that, the afterglow can help, because then we have, you know, with AGN, you have much better localization in electromagnetic counterparts.
Just to clarify, when you say afterglow,
you use the phrase GRB, you say
long and short GRB, which we didn't explain that. That just means gamma ray burst, burst of gamma rays. But then after the burst of gamma rays, there's this afterglow of radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum. So we see it in X-rays, we see it in radio. But yeah, so then you can ask if you can see, this after, because it lasts for a long time. You can see if there's any evidence for these afterglows
associated with the coincidentally.
And that would tell you that maybe there were two neutron stars that merged, or maybe there was a really massive star that
collapsed and
produced a gamma ray burst at some point. I realized I started to use terms without an explanation.
It's my job
to interrupt you when you do that. Good. So that's an example of the type of stuff. What's the big thing that you've done in this field that you're excited about or that you're working on right now in trying to understand these things?
With the AGN specifically?
Sure. If we want, we can shift gears since you work on so many things. Is there a big contribution that you can think of that you're most proud of, or?
Like overall, there are a few work where I feel like I have that I'm, you know, whether other people may think or not the same, I don't know, but for me, I feel like I'm mostly proud of for example, this was like in magnetars when, early in the, when this, so magnetars are very highly magnetized neutron stars. That were seen by their occasional outburst of energy. And early on, these magnetars were seen as a special class, of magnetic field about 100 times or more than the usual neutron stars that we see as pulsar. And there was a clear separation between the two, and, you know, people thought of understanding, there are certain properties. There's a subclass, right? So the very strong magnetic field does that, causes the crust to break and so forth, and then there are the others that, on the other hand, they're just a radio pulsar. And then what happened, there was the world started to change as some objects with lower magnetic field, which were in the pulsar regime, as you expect a normal neutron star, let's say, were seen to outburst like a characteristic of magnetars. And some other objects that were more with relatively higher B field that were behaving more like, the normal neutron star. So all of a sudden, this paradigm became blurred.
You had these neutron stars, you had regular neutron stars that had a magnetic field that was not necessarily very strong, and then you have magnetars, which are like really strongly magnetized, and they used to be thought of as totally separate classes. But then it seems like we discovered objects that were kind of in between the two.
And so something to be said that we have a way to measure the magnetic field, which is based on measurement of the period and period derivative, and that's mm-hmm. the polar component, because that's the direct way by which we measure
quickly it's losing angular momentum and energy and spinning down.
Exactly. So that's the way we measure the magnetic field. So there was a context, and that was where I started to be thinking with a collaborator from Jose Ponce from Spain, who was doing numerical simulations of magnetic field evolution in the neutron star crust. And what we realized, because as a theorist, you can simulate also the field that you don't see directly, because what we measure directly is the dipolar component, whereas what you can simulate is also the toroidal component, which is within the crust.
Okay, so basically as a theorist, the magnetic field inside the neutron star.
Exactly.
There's no way of observing that directly, but you can, as a theorist, you can try to see what happens when you play around with that.
Exactly.
Just why we like to do theory,
exactly.
Right?
And basically what we realized was that the significance of the having a stronger internal field, they call it toroidal, but it's basically confined within the crust, which we don't measure directly with mm-hmm. the measurements that we're used to do, but however has an influence in the way the objects behaves observationally. So basically this very strong field can in the interior can cause the crust to break, and therefore having outburst for an object that for the polar field is low and normally would appear as a regular object.
So the idea is that it's not just about the magnetic field we can see, but if there's this interior magnetic field that can make depending on what it looks like, it can make a regular neutron star do things like a magnetar or something like that. Is that
the idea. So for I felt like there was a theoretical understanding of this observational phenomenology that was very puzzling, but we were able to account for this purpose. So there was no real a division between the two, and in fact the title of the paper is a unified but it's basically it's just the one population it's the same neutron star where you have an external field that we measure that mm-hmm. before was the only thing we relied on, and there is an internal component for which there are other theoretical arguments for its existence, and which then determines contributes to determining the properties that we see. So that's there was one paper in particular that
that's very cool, because that's obviously kind of a profound understanding of a lot of how neutron stars work. That's very cool. I don't mean to embarrass you by saying it. Anyway, let me ask now we're sort of winding down, we'll shift gears. So in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics? I know this is hard. I should have prepared you for this question.
It's interesting. It's interesting. I feel like I was actually talking with one of my one of my former students about that, because it's sometimes I also personally feel like I don't, astrophysics doesn't do, at least a lot of the theoretical astrophysics that we do doesn't affect directly humanity, and I feel like at times I feel like I should be doing something medicine or research in an area where it has a direct benefit to human beings. But then other times I feel like if more people were to actually focus about think about the universe and how small we are, I think there will be less wars. I think people my feeling, people fight for 2 meters of land, and it's we're this tiny dot in this enormous with billions of other stars and billions of galaxies. So I feel like if some of these people that are in power and they're you know, start your wars over.
Right. I think everything very local seems all so important, and then you realize, like, we're nothing. Feel like,
so that is my belief, that if astrophysics was more, was communicating, people were actually led, you know, like, say, take all these people fighting wars and put them in a room and let them look at the universe and describe the universe and how small we are, I think they would be less keen to, like, to fighting and to... Right. So that's what my answer to I think everybody should study astrophysics.
I mean, that would be great if that...
But that wouldn't work.
I would, that's a very interesting answer, because I do agree that people who think a lot more about astrophysics and do tend to, like, you spend a lot of time thinking about, like, these giant things that are, like, a million times the size of the sun, and then somebody says, well, you're...
You are a daughter.
Yeah, there's this, like, all those little, little fights that we have seem very trivial in comparison.
That is my my answer.
I think it's a great answer. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr.
It was fun.
I had a lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you will join us again sometime.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was quite interesting. I don't know if you could tell, but Rosalba gave me a bit of a mental workout there, trying to keep up with what she was saying and making sure we took the time to flesh out all the details. When you pair a sharp mind with an Italian tongue, you get a very fast-paced conversation. So I hope I did okay. Thank you again, Dr. Perna, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. The music you hear on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford, with the full versions on her album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Please look her up if you enjoyed it. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University.